Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. Now, in this episode, I speak to Sam and Chris of the Earn More, Spend Less, and Invest the Rest YouTube channel. They have a really interesting journey through personal finance and investing. Chris actually got a Philtown book from his mum in around 2008, and that really kickstarted his journey into discovering value investing and the world of Warren Buffett and Monish Pabrai and Guy Spier and so on. And together, him and Sam have made some pretty serious changes in terms of how they manage their personal finances and investing. And they've made some seriously good progress in terms of getting towards financial freedom. So this was a really fun and interesting discussion with both Chris and Sam. If you want to check out more from them on YouTube, their channel will be linked down in the description below if you're watching on YouTube, or in the show notes on whichever audio platform you might be listening to this episode on. So without further ado, let's roll this one with Sam and Chris, and I hope you enjoy it. Sam and Chris, welcome to the podcast. I've been spending the last week or so watching several of your YouTube videos, and it seems like we have quite the overlap in investment strategy and philosophy on a lot of things money. So I'm excited to talk to both of you. How are you doing?
We're doing super good, and we're so happy to be on the podcast. Thank you for having us, Tom.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, for sure. I'm looking forward to this. So maybe for those that haven't come across your YouTube channel before, tell us a little bit about what you're up to there and a little bit about your backgrounds and getting into personal finance and investing in the first place.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, sounds good. So, okay. A little bit about our background. We're originally from the U.S., as you can probably tell from our accents. They're very strong. But we've been lucky enough to live overseas for about the past 11 years. We lived in Australia for a while, and we spent about 7 years in Dubai. We just left. Chris retired from his job, so that happened about 2 weeks ago. So we're in a super good mood. We're very feeling nice. Happy. But yeah, our whole philosophy is you have kind of three parts to achieving financial freedom, which is you've got to earn more, you've got to spend less, and you have to invest what's left over. And so kind of that holistic approach is what we like to talk about on our channel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it starts with value investing, which is something we got into, I would say it's around 2008, probably about the same time as the global financial crisis. I received a copy of Philtown's Rule Number One from my mom, actually, mm-hmm. Really got kind of dug into that, and it pretty much clicked, you know. And it was also a very kind of good time to start thinking about investing when you see, I guess, the market going through, you know, a pretty bad time where you see a lot of fear in the market. And just to be aware that kind of thing can happen, you know, because I think definitely a lot of people new to investing right now have just been seeing kind of an upward moving market for the last 12 or 13 years. So it's good to have that exposure to kind of the fearful side. As Warren Buffett said, there was definitely a lot of blood in the streets. You know, so we were kind of learning the ropes then, and we've continued to educate ourselves as, you know, with value investing for the last 12 years. So
yeah,
it's definitely been something that has been very rewarding for us. And then when you see the power of compounding and value investing, it really kind of motivates you to, you know,
learn
spend
more.
A little bit less, earn a little bit more, spend a little bit less, and have some more to really invest.
Yeah. And I actually remember I very clearly remember we were at our apartment complex in Dubai, and it was summer, and we were sitting around the pool. And, you know, it's a very typical story, right, of people who are working in high stress jobs, and the nature of our work would take us not only away from our family who are, you know, it was just us in Dubai, and we would even be away from each other. The work that I do required me to travel a lot and things like that. And we just went, enough of this. Like, we do not want to do this until we're 65. We have to do something differently. And it was like we had that epiphany that day in the pool. And even though we had read the book before, it was like we had that epiphany. And then it was like, okay, we're on a mission now. Let's change our behaviors. Let's really make a plan. Let's commit to doing this, and let's set some goals. So, you know, that was a big change.
Yeah. I think I had just gotten back from a trip to Bangladesh for work, where I spent about 3 months
pretty dreadful.
On the Ganges River up in northern Bangladesh during monsoon season, and he came back
like 30 pounds lighter.
It definitely made me think, you know, maybe there's something else that I can do.
Yeah.
So we wanted to make a big change, and we knew it was going to take time, but that's probably where it started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very cool. And it looks like it's definitely starting to pay off now if you're just getting to the point of retiring from a job, right?
It is, but I think it's a lifelong journey. So it's got to continue. And we need to, you know, be mindful of what we're doing and be putting thought into that and in practicing, you know, everything we've learned over the last 13, 14 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. So what were some of the kind of changes that you made around that time? Obviously, there's sort of the investing part and getting that value investing framework, but you guys are often talking about sort of the personal finance parts of it as well, and actually spending less money and bringing more and, you know, the top line, kind of to get all three of those aspects sort of working together. So maybe talk us through that progression. What are some of the things you kind of put in place to pull all the right levers and sort of fast track towards financial independence?
Sure. Great question. So I think the first thing before, like, even getting into some of the practical tips and things that we did, the very foundation is having the right mindset. And, you know, Chris was talking about understanding the power of compounding interest. It's like, once you get how money works, you're like, oh, I'm going to take advantage of this. Like, this is great. This is knowledge I did not learn when I was younger. So that's a really big part of the mindset, is understanding compounding interest. But I think another part that is incredibly important and that we had to really actively work on a daily basis is really, Charlie Munger says, live by an internal scorecard, or is that Warren Buffett?
Both.
But, you know, not keeping up with the Joneses. And to be very honest, in Dubai,
it's very hard when all your friends are driving Range Rovers and
Lamborghinis
and Porsches, and you've got a 2011 Renault Duster. But it's, you know, you've got to do it. No matter where you are in your financial journey, you know, any wealthy person, if you're going to amass wealth, you have to live below your means. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, we find it so, you can't go back in life. So, you know, something that we've really practiced is when we increase our salaries, our earnings, we don't increase our
major
living
expenses.
Costs, you know, and that's something we had been doing previously. And we had to find that, you know, we just have to kind of stick to what we've got right now and let our earnings kind of to grow on their own and put away that additional income and have something to invest, have that dry powder to invest.
Yeah. And I think, Tom, to get more on kind of the practical side as well, too. So that's the mindset stuff. But very practically, some things that happened that enabled us to earn more. Of course, you know, you've got side hustles and you've got investments. And I always like to say that you have side hustles and passive income. And I feel like if you have time, you can do a side hustle. And if you have a little bit of money, you can try to do some passive investments. And of course, there's overlap, but everybody has one of those two things. And so we started exploring different investment vehicles and we're starting new side hustles over the past couple of years. Mm. But one of the biggest things that is relevant for us specifically is maximizing your primary source of income. So for us, we really benefited from investing as professionals within our careers. So I think Warren Buffett always says that being a good investor has helped him to be a good business manager, and being a good business manager helps him to invest. And so once we really started understanding the language of investing and looking at businesses and thinking, how is the management performing? What do I want to see from an investment? We actually started applying that in our own careers. And so we were able to get promotions. We were promoted to senior leadership positions. We started speaking that language and our company CEOs were like, oh, okay, give them more things to manage, you know? And so we were really, for us, living in Dubai, of course, Dubai is a tax-free place, so that also helped us financially. But we really tried to squeeze every drop of juice out of that opportunity with our 9-to-5 and really maximize our opportunity and practice that delayed gratification, mm-hmm. thinking of ourselves like, you know, what about 40-year-old Sam? What about 50-year-old Sam? How will she feel? What will she want? Let me do her some favors and not buy that Louis Vuitton purse. I don't need it. you know? So I think that's really important. I think for me, the thing that was most helpful when I was first getting started, in addition to having a budget and making a plan for your money, I think you really have to understand what you're spending. And personally, for a full 4 months, I actually kept a little paper notebook in my purse. And I wrote down every single penny that I spent, you know, and then I would look back at the end of the week and I would go, holy shit, I just spent, you know, $50 on chocolate bars. It was too much. So I think writing down everything that you spend is really important. That was a really great practical tip. And something else that really helped me to continually reinforce the motivation is having like a visual cue. So, I had a tendency to do a bit of online shopping. And so I actually changed the screensaver to an image of like a dream house, you know, that me and Chris would like to retire to back in Florida. And so just having that visual reminder, it's like, oh, you know what? I don't actually need to buy that. That's not something I need. Let me take that money and invest it. So just implementing practical tips like that, reinforcing your motivation, and yeah, really committing to living below your means, I think is something that helped us immensely.
Yeah. And I think you always have to have something that you splurge on a little bit. And, and for us that, you know, we'll usually do some sort of travel during the year to
keep our sanity.
Yeah. To some, to some nice place and enjoy that. And that's, you know, what we spend some money on, but in the other aspects of life, we, you know, we just try to live far below our means.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. You're saying a lot of things that resonate a lot with me. I think we have very, I think we think about these things very similarly. Like you even talk about the, you know, putting a screensaver of the dream home. I don't have that, but in my online banking app on my phone, I have a picture of, Warren Buffett drinking a Cherry Coke. And that just reminds me of like the power of compounding. And if you spend a dollar today, you know, you're potentially giving up $8 or whatever it is in the future. That like compounding mental model I've got kind of drilled into my head. So that's a nice little reminder. And you mentioned a couple other things that I'm a big kind of fan of as well. So the whole idea of essentially avoiding lifestyle creep. So when you do get pay rises, not necessarily going out and just spending that all straight away. Like in my situation, I'm more or less living on the exact same budget that I was like 5 years ago, fresh out of university in a little one bedroom flat with my girlfriend kind of thing. And I've had pay rises and had the YouTube channel and that sort of thing start up, you know, over those years as well. And that really does like push your head quite quickly. So that's very cool to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's that exponential kind of growth of it. Yeah. But we're in the exact same boat too. And I remember last year we were really looking at upgrading our housing situation. Mm-hmm. And then me and Chris sat down and we just said, no, let's not do it yet. Yeah. You know, like let's do a couple more years in a smaller apartment and we don't need it. You know, we're okay the way we are. And yeah, totally agree.
Yeah, for sure. I guess that there's always going to be some times where like you have these strategies that from time to time will make you look like a bit of an idiot. I think like, you know, it's, I have a few friends that have bought houses, for example, and borrowed a lot of money and that's appreciated a lot. And then, you know, if you're renting a small place, it, you know, makes that look like kind of a bad decision. And you see the same thing in stock markets. Like you take this very disciplined value investing approach and all of a sudden, you know, your friend's buying Zoom or something, then goes up 5x or whatever it was. But then, you know, in the long term, you know, those things tend to come back to earth and tends to work out well in the long run, right?
Absolutely. And yeah, cool. And we sleep at night well, you know, knowing what we own, we're okay to, you know.
Yeah, I like it. So tell us a bit about the investing strategy. You mentioned Phil Town, you discovered in about 2008, I think you said it was, which is prime time, I would say, to be discovering a strategy about how you should be investing in stock markets, because it was fairly, I wasn't investing in 2008. You're a few years ahead of me, but I imagine there would have been some pretty cheap stuff, you know, some of these 50 cent dollars and things that Phil Town talks about kind of lying on the ground. So how has the strategy evolved from learning Phil Town to today? Are there any significant changes or do you still largely follow that philosophy?
No, we still largely follow it. And, you know, you start to hear it repeated in every true value investor down the line, the same different practices, you know, and the same for the most part. Each investor have their own nuance, but for the most part, you know, you start to hear the same message. And so we still follow that. Back in 2008, when we were getting into it, you know, there's a difference between understanding something and then feeling so confident that you're willing to put what little money we had at that time on everything. And I look back on it and you could, you know, you could put your money in any great company and it was being traded at pennies on the dollar. But yeah, we had to kind of learn the process slowly to have the commitment to put, you know, a large sums of money onto anything. But we had, you know, there were a couple good opportunities we did with what little money we were investing. We did well. I think I had about a 5x on one and about 100x on another. So, wow.
Well, and at the time as well, too. I was quite resistant at first. Like if you read the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and how he talks about how poor dad is like, get an education, work until you're sick. That's what I grew up with. Like, you know, education is the most important and just work hard and live, you know, well below your means and you'll be good, you know, once you're at retirement age, like in your 60s and 70s. And I remember Chris came to me and he was like, babe, Ford is trading at a dollar. I think maybe we should just buy some Ford stock. And I was like, no, we're not buying any stock. So it definitely took me a minute to come around, but it's like Chris says, I think using paper money, right, on Thinkorswim was really helpful. You just have to build up your confidence. And to be honest, it was scary too, because we were seeing, you know, people just a little bit older than us, you know, losing all their money and just being devastated. Yeah. And so we're very risk adverse naturally.
Being in Florida specifically was very hard. You know, if you see
The Big Short.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was when they go down and visit Florida, this was the epicenter of the housing boom and bust. And we were just seeing, you know, foreclosure signs on every house down the street. It was a tough time, especially leaving university. It was a very tough time to be looking for a job, especially in the engineering industry. You know, everyone that had graduated, that was in my class or a couple years older, who had graduated maybe last year, people were fighting over them. Employers were fighting over them. And then, you know, they were losing their jobs. I was having a hard time finding jobs. So we're holding on to every penny pretty tight at that point. Mm-hmm. But like I said, it was a great experience to live through and to just have a little bit of understanding of investing at that point and to be able to see what can happen to a market when, you know, fear takes grip. And it's scary to see, but it's also a huge opportunity if you know what you're doing.
Yeah. But you know, Tom, you asked like, has it changed recently? And I think the biggest thing for us that's changed recently is we really have to combat like FOMO. Right. Because just like what you said, there are your friends who are investing in what we would consider very unwise investments. And they're like 10xing their money in a couple of months. And so really sticking to those principles, being disciplined. We've started doing a very, very small part of our portfolio. We're doing some index investing just to kind of continue to stay engaged in the market. But you know, we don't know what's going to happen. You know, I know you're watching The Economist as well, too.
Yeah. And even that index investing, we're doing a little bit of cost averaging. Yeah. And we're happy if it goes down. We're happy if what we've put in it so far goes down so that we can buy the S&P at lower prices. Mm-hmm. And again, it's just a little thing that we're doing to try to remove some emotion from, you know, really sitting on the sidelines in a lot of cash. At least we've got something working for us and we feel, I don't know, we're just doing these small things to try to remove some emotion. Yeah. But the majority of our portfolio is still looking to invest in wonderful businesses at hopefully fair prices. But
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. Just out of interest, a couple of questions. Do you mind sharing what the 100 bagger was? Is that something you still own?
It was Sirius XM radio. I bought at 7 cents and I sold it at $7.04 about 6 years later.
That is crazy. What was the story there? It was just absurdly cheap or grew a lot, or it's a combination of both.
I was working with a construction project down on Lake Okeechobee, down close to the Everglades, with a couple of buddies that I worked with. They were investing in penny stocks, and they just talked to me about it. And I actually liked XM radio. I knew a lot of friends who were for different parts of the country, and they only got their baseball or their basketball games aired on XM radio. So they all had XM radio in their cars, and they would go sit out in a parking lot and listen to their local sports teams back wherever they were from. And you were seeing it, you know, when you bought a car, you got it with XM radio usually. And I don't know. It was 7 cents. It wasn't a big investment. And yeah, it was a 100 pack or so. It wasn't a lot of, wasn't a lot more thought than that. Just that I thought they had a good product. I mean, they're still around and still doing well.
So I've also been a follower of Phil Town for a few years now at this point, but one of the parts of Phil Town's strategy that I haven't sort of utilized before is his use of options. I've heard him, I mean, I've seen it show up in some of his very obscure SEC filings, I should say, but I have seen it show up in some of those filings with his use of put options and call options, which, as I understand it, are essentially ways for him to just buy into and sell out of investments that he would like to own kind of at the right price anyway. I don't, at least as I understand it, I don't think he's trading options on just random companies. He's still trying to find sort of companies that still kind of fit his core philosophy. Am I understanding that correctly? And are you guys using that in a similar sort of way?
Yeah, we use it in the exact same way. And we think that, you know, trading options is incredibly risky unless you really pair it with value investing. So we're putting values on a business, and then using options to basically enter that position and get paid to enter that position at a price at or below the intrinsic value of the business. So we are, every month we're selling put options on companies we want to own at with strike prices that we want to buy them at, and we're getting paid to do that. So it's a way to generate cash flow when the stocks we want to own are above what we would consider intrinsic value. We're using that cash flow to de-risk our position, get our money back off the table. And it's just a great way to participate in a market that might be a little bit overpriced. But for us, there's no additional downside risk than just buying the company outright. There is maybe an upside risk if it's, if the stock shoots up and you never get put that stock, well, then you might miss a big upside potential, but for us, there's no additional downside risk.
Mm-hmm. And presumably, I mean, if you do miss the stocks that run up, I mean, they're the types of investments that if you weren't using options, you also wouldn't have bought them anyway. So is that kind of how you view it? Like, you know, it would have been nice to own them and have the, you know, quick run up in price, but if you weren't using options, you probably would have had the same experience, except you wouldn't have collected the option premium, right?
Right. Yeah. And the way we position is we usually leave a little bit of whatever money we were going to allocate to that position anyways on the side. So if it does drop below the intrinsic value, we'll buy at least a small position, we'll tranche in a small position, and we'll have put options at lower strike prices. So we'll try to take advantage of it that way. But you could sell a put option with a month expiry, and it could drop below your intrinsic value, and it could climb back up before the expiration date, and then you don't get put the stock. So you have to be a little bit, aware of that and take advantage of it by just buying the stock outright, buying at least a percentage of it.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you think through, because I'm roughly familiar with this strategy, but we don't have easy access to options in New Zealand, so I've never actually done this myself, but I mean, how do you think about sizing those types of positions? Because you're, when you get put the stock, you've presumably got to have fairly substantial kind of cash reserves to, buy that so position, right?
We're only selling put options on companies we want to own, and you have to own at least you want to have to buy at least 100 shares. So it's really a way that we use to invest. So it is a company that we want to own. It's a long-term investment. We're happy to own however many contracts we are put. Mm-hmm. And
we can afford to own that many contracts. You know, yeah, we're very systematic and diligent about the way that we structure.
Absolutely. They're always cash covered or cash secured puts. Mm-hmm. But we just think it's a great way to really add some cash flow, de-risk our investments and participate in an overpriced market.
Yeah, very cool. And so do you use those, so that's sort of entering the position with selling puts, do you sell calls on the other end when things get expensive as well?
Yeah, we actually do. And our normal allocation to any individual business is usually a range instead of an exact number. So I might say I want to own between 1,000 and 1,200 shares. And sometimes, so I will actually sell puts and sell calls in between 1,000 and 1,200 to continue generating cash flow. So I'm
collecting those premiums.
Yeah. We're happy if the stock runs away and we only own 1,000. We're happy if it sits there and we own 1,200. So we'll sell calls to generate some additional mm-hmm. cash flow. And then, you know, when we do our valuation, if it's incredibly overvalued at any one point, we might sell calls out of the money. And if it gets called away from us, then you have to be okay with that. Mm-hmm. And but if it's a long-term investment, we usually hang back with some. You know, we don't want to see some huge run up and we've sold it at 40 and now it's $110.
Yeah. That would be very sad.
So if it's a wonderful business still selling at a great price, we're usually not selling calls on it too aggressively.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. This is maybe changing tack slightly, but how do you guys sort of approach making investments as a couple? I know I've spoken to a couple of couples on the podcast before. Mm-hmm. And it's always an interesting one because not always, but oftentimes there's sort of one person in the relationship that, you know, is sort of in charge of the finances or handles whatever part of the finances and investments or even just, you know, day-to-day paying bills and that sort of thing. So when you actually research a company and, you know, one of you is interested in kind of putting it into the portfolio, how's that process work? Like presumably you have slightly different circles of competence as well. So, mm-hmm. you know, what's the process for you guys in practice?
Well, we definitely have very different circles of competence, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. I think, like I mentioned before, in the beginning, I was quite resistant. And I think, you know, just speaking for myself, but a lot of the women that I speak to are quite afraid of investing because I think a lot of us have a fear of math. And I was very much like that. You know, in the beginning, I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm smart enough to invest. And something that I always tell my girlfriends and my colleagues is I'm like, girl, if you were smart enough to earn that money, you're smart enough to invest that money. And so once I realized that, you know, it's simple math, and I was really lucky because Chris's greatest strength is he really has a lot of financial acumen very naturally, and he's very analytical. And so, you know, we work together and we try to bring our different strengths to the table. We definitely look at the story of a business different, you know, like he's a numbers man. I really look at, I think my strengths are around communication and relationship building and everything that has to do with people. So I like to look at how the management handles things. And, you know, from the leadership perspective, that's a little bit about my background and what I do with my career. And so what we try to do is bring our different strengths to the table, but we also play devil's advocate. We love arguing. That's one of our favorite things to do as a married couple. So part of it, like you said, Tom, when one of us finds something we want to invest in, we have to convince the other person. And the other person is like, well, I don't know. Let me poke some holes into this.
If we can convince the other, we know it's a pretty good investment.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice.
We'll argue just to argue.
Yeah, we love arguing.
And what about the circle of competence part? How's that work? Has there ever been situations where one of you sort of understands that industry or that company really well and the other person is maybe a little newer to it? I mean, do those investments end up in the portfolio or how's that sort of work?
Absolutely. That absolutely happens. And I actually think, and this is kind of like a crossover into YouTube, you don't really understand something until you can teach it to another person. So like what Chris said, like convincing the other person, you know, if there's an investment that has to do with like the energy sector or oil or gas or anything like that, like Chris really knows that industry very well. And I might not be as familiar with it, but if he's able to really clearly articulate that to me to understand the investment, I poke holes, I have lots of questions, lots of doubts. Like he said, if you can convince the other person, especially when it's outside their circle of competency, then that really gives us a lot of confidence that this business is worth investing in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nice. What's the ideal structure of the portfolio for you guys? We had a couple of technical issues, and in between earlier, Chris was mentioning around, you know, sort of an upper limit you guys have in terms of sizing an individual position. What's that framework sort of look like for you, and what's the thought process behind that?
Well, we're probably a little bit less concentrated than some value investors. We feel confident owning up to 30 companies, but we want the vast majority, 60-70% in a handful. At the moment, we don't have any companies with that kind of level of conviction that we're willing to put that mm-hmm. that kind of money in there. But that's why we're taking smaller positions in some companies that we think are great companies being traded at a fair price. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would say we're more concentrated than most, but far less than others.
Well, and I think, Tom, too, for us as well, you know, we are entering kind of a new phase in our financial freedom journey. And so in addition to stock, we've successfully invested in real estate in the past. And so we want to make sure that if we find great opportunities in real estate, and also our long-term vision for our investment portfolio also includes investment in small businesses. You know, we're interested in generating passive income in whatever form that comes and whatever's most lucrative. And we really enjoy learning about those different industries, and you know, making money's fun.
Yeah,
however you can do it, right?
Yeah, for sure. And actually one of the other things we were just talking about in our little break there was around applying value investing principles to other asset classes, things like real estate. I know you guys have some interesting thoughts you're keen to share on that topic.
Yeah, absolutely. We think that investing between different asset classes is really the same thing. There's so many similarities. So when you look at a rental property, to me and to Sam, a rental property is really just a business. You know, it's throwing off cash at the end of every month. It's going to be there, you know, throw off cash when you sell it. So you can do a discount cash flow on a rental property, just like you would do a discount cash flow on a stock. Mm-hmm. And for us, really, you know, I think when you look at something really tangible, like a rental property, I think it's much easier for people generally to understand that as an investment, and to kind of picture it compared to a stock. We often see a disconnect between, you know, people's perception of a stock being just a piece of paper, not a share of a business that, mm-hmm. that throws off cash at the end of every year, and that you can buy and sell pieces of that business, and that it's a productive asset. Mm-hmm. But you look at it as a rental property, and I think it clicks a lot easier.
Yeah.
So we view investing in rental properties the exact same we would in a stock. And we look for the four things that,
yeah,
you know, Phil Town talks about, or yeah, Charlie Munger, you know. You're looking for a property. One, I think we all understand what a rental property is. We all, you know, Sam and I have owned a lot of properties, but we've always been renters. We've never owned our own home. So it's something we understand very deeply. But also, you know, you want to know that either if you're going to manage it yourself, you're a decent manager, or you're going to have somebody manage it for you, the property is going to have durable competitive advantages. You want to know that somebody's going to want to live there in 20 years from now. It's going to have good schools. It's going to be in a good location. Mm-hmm. In Florida, it's not too close to the coast. It won't get flooded.
Yeah.
And then you're just going to buy it.
Lesson learned on that one. Flood insurance is a killer. Yeah.
And then you're going to buy it for a decent price. That makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think every, you know, most assets you can look at the exact same way.
Yeah, cool. I completely agree. And I think for people that understand the real estate equation, looking at stocks as if they were, you know, rental properties that throw off cash flow, and, you know, what's an intelligent price to pay for that cash flow, is a nice kind of mental framework to get people in the door with understanding value investing and investing in stocks in a similar way. Do you find that investing in real estate one of the things that I kind of struggle with real estate versus investing in stocks is I feel like with just stock markets generally have obviously a big reputation for being incredibly volatile, particularly in the short term. So that creates a lot of opportunity for people like us where, you know, we're looking to buy businesses at deep discounts to intrinsic value where, whereas in real estate, I feel like there's generally that person has a pretty good understanding of what their property is worth when they're selling it. Maybe there's a range, but could you talk through your experience in that area? Like, are there opportunities that have come up where you've been able to find little inefficiencies? Is it just a case of hunting around property after property after property, or do you have to pay up a little bit more for some of these things?
There's probably a little bit of both. I mean, there's a lot of hunting for properties, making lots of offers and making lots of, you know, lowball offers and expecting only to get maybe a few percent accepted. And then there's also the opportunity to put in a lot of sweat equity. You know, if you're willing to go in and to upgrade a property through your own effort, you know, then maybe you can invest. But right now it's a very hot market in the U.S.
Oh, it's we wouldn't buy anything today in Florida. Everything is wildly priced. But I will say this: I also think, Tom, that one of the big differences between stock and real estate is I think so much of real estate success is relationship based. You know, it's me taking our mortgage broker out to lunch and learning about her family and then her really advocating for us so that we can get a loan to buy 10 properties at one time, or, you know, getting to know the wholesaler, getting to know lawyers, probate lawyers, you know, so that when opportunities come up, we're at the top of their head, and that gives you that competitive advantage. Right. So I think you have to, you know, when we talked about using our different skill sets, I really enjoy, you know, meeting with people and connecting with those people. So I think if you find the right people and, you know, and it's like that with stock investing too, you want to find like-minded friends and peers who are doing the same thing as you, speaking the same language. But I think in real estate, though, the way to break down those barriers is to really develop those relationships.
Yeah. And, you know, I have this motto in life that the more mutually beneficial relationships you can create in life, the more successful you're going to be. And I think that's really demonstrated well in real estate investing. You know, everything is a mutually beneficial relationship. If you're buying lots of properties, then the agent is going to do better.
Yeah, they're getting commissions.
The property manager is going to make, the more successful you are, the more money the property manager is going to make. You know, the more real estate you're buying, you might have a contractor, the better he's going to do.
Exactly.
And it's something, it's very much relationship based. So there are opportunities that are hard to find. It is very different in that it's a lot more hands-on, but you have a lot more control too. You're not relying on a CEO and a management team to allocate capital. You are the allocator of that capital. So it gives you that kind of opportunity. If you can allocate it well, then you have control over that capital. So.
Yeah, very cool. It seems like a great way for a lot of people to get started. I mean, even Charlie Munger, I think in the early days was very into real estate and real estate development. I mean, particularly because, as I understand it, at least he didn't have kind of a lot of money to work with at that time and could borrow a bunch of it. So, I mean, from an analytical perspective, how do you think about the capacity to borrow in real estate versus stocks kind of changing the equation? Does that help you lean more towards making real estate deals?
Yeah, absolutely. That leverage will help you in the right environment. But, you have to really start with the property and make sure it has durable competitive advantages. So maybe there's you know, land barriers that are going to limit the amount of building. Maybe there's zoning codes that are limiting the amount of building. We just came from Dubai and it just seems like they keep building villas out into the desert and it's an endless supply of villas. And that's not an area that I would feel comfortable taking out a mortgage on and buying. But you want to make sure that you can get that unit rented and that somebody is always paying that mortgage for you. And then, you're really leveraging your return.
But I think, Tom, no matter what, like if you're not getting that property at what you consider to be a fair value, if you're not getting that margin of safety, you know, if you take out a loan and it's too big of a loan for that property, that's a bad investment. So I think understanding the numbers is vitally important.
100%.
Just like with a stock, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. It's yeah, it's the whole, again, Buffett and Munger ideas of you know, no matter how great the business or how great the property, I guess you got to pay a reasonable price, or else it doesn't really make sense, right?
Absolutely.
Which does lead me into, I apologize in advance, but a slightly more painful topic for you both, around investing mistakes. again in our little technical issue break there, we got talking about one of the investment mistakes that you made a few years ago in a company that probably quite a few people will be familiar with if they've followed some of the super investors that we follow, the Guy Spiers and Monish Pabrias, and also learning from, you know, someone like Phil Town. Are you happy to share that story of what happened there and maybe some learnings?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Samantha and I were invested in Horsehead. We followed a few great investors into it. We definitely were cloning them. And, you know, still we did a lot of research. We thought it was a great investment. I still look at that investment and think, well, how did that not pay off? Mm-hmm. It was, Horsehead was a zinc producer that was building this amazing zinc refining plant, mm-hmm. I think in North Carolina. They were the low-cost producer. This was going to cut their costs in half. Zinc was at a very low price. So you could make some reasonable assumptions that, you know, zinc could approach cyclical highs and that they got this plan off the ground and cut their cost basis and that this investment could 10x. And I think we also came across this at a time. It would have been only maybe that year that we had this conversation at the pool where we said, epiphany. Let's really work on our investing. Mm-hmm. Let's retire. Let's do some things. And we probably forgot one of our biggest rules, which was not to go all in on a single investment. Mm-hmm. And
to not get emotional. Because we were greedy. We were like, oh my God, if this pans out the way we think, we could be retired next year, not in 5 years, you know? Yeah. And we just let emotions take over.
Yeah. And obviously they went into Chapter 11 and shareholders lost all of our money. So mm-hmm. it is a painful thing. Yeah. My Sirius XM radio investment just went. So you say the wall of fame and the wall of shame, they're right next to each other.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest, it was a great lesson for us to learn. There is no get rich quick scheme in investing. Mm-hmm. It's not a safe thing, you know? So it's a lot about positioning and allocation of capital and not putting all your
eggs in one basket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No matter what Warren Buffett says.
Yeah. What's the Buffett quote? It's something like, it's okay to
put all your eggs in one basket and then watch that basket.
Just watch the basket very closely. It's an interesting one because I've listened to Phil Town has a podcast episode for anyone that hasn't heard it on Horsehead, and I've listened to that a couple of times, and I try to put myself in, I guess, the shoes that you were in at the time of trying to analyze Horsehead as a potential investment. And I think I probably would have invested in it and had made the same mistake, to be perfectly honest, even knowing how it panned out. I guess it's the whole idea of investing being a game of probabilities, and occasionally things come out of left field when, you know, even all the stars do seem to align. And I guess that's the reason why we, you know, have limits in terms of portfolio allocation and so on. And I believe, maybe it wasn't this company. I think it was Horsehead though, where Monish Pabrai got this call from Charlie Munger after reading Monish's letter, basically debriefing on what happened with Horsehead. And he told him something along the lines of, you know, learn from it, but don't learn too much. I guess, in other words, like, you know, it's a mistake, it happens, it's kind of par for the course. And I've had investments like that where I've lost a little bit of money before. And I still come away from a lot of those things kind of thinking that I would make that same bet again if it was presented to me. Do you have similar takeaways from that? Or are there key things that you think you just genuinely missed that should have been picked up?
No, I think the investment thesis was sound, saying that, you know, but I think the it was just the position size. It's something we should, you know, we really are limiting ourselves to 10% at the most with a highly, you know, with a lot of conviction that that's as much of our portfolio as we would put into any one position. And that's a lot for us. And this was well over that.
Yeah.
And again, it was the, we wanted to change our life so quickly. And we thought this could potentially be it. Because yeah. I think
we thought it was a golden ticket.
Yeah. We easily thought it could 10X. And it was really down to this refining plant they had in North Carolina getting up and running. And it just had some teething problems very early on. And it really, they had their debt called, and a fairly aggressive hedge fund owned most of their debt, and their assets were marked down on their balance sheet. And then basically there was nothing left when the primary debt lender got paid. So shareholders lost everything. But and it's been too painful for us to actually go back and see as a private company how the Horsehead is doing. They're probably doing very well.
They're probably doing hedge fund is probably real happy.
Right. So Horsehead's still around. It's come out of bankruptcy and it's the new plant's operational, is it?
Well, I think so. We don't know.
We're still bitter. It's still salty for us.
Fair enough. Yeah, it's interesting, like how these things play out. I guess the lesson coming out of that is portfolio allocation, and you know, it's, I think people hear, you know, the old Warren Buffett talks where he says, you know, if I was only managing $1 million, I'd have 50% in my best idea, and I'd be making 50% a year, and I've been reading The Snowball. I'm not sure if you guys have read that or not, the Warren Buffett biography, but some of the stories of stocks that he was able to purchase, and that, you know, like he was buying, I think in one example, he had about 50 or 60% of his portfolio in one stock, but it was trading at like 0.5 times earnings or something like that.
Right.
So that's the environment where Buffett was talking about making 50% bets. It's not, you know, paying 10 times sales for some new software company that's grown really fast.
Exactly. And
that's
everything,
you know, so
yeah.
And unfortunately, the three of us aren't Warren Buffett either. So, we probably have to scale things down, right?
Isn't that lame? I wish we were.
We can dream. switching tech a little bit, hopefully onto a slightly more positive subject. Tell us about what your plans are with YouTube. I believe you've just ticked over 1,000 subscribers fairly recently, so congratulations on that. What are the plans with the YouTube channel and trying to grow that?
We're trying to be like you.
Oh, come on.
You've got to be much bigger
than that.
No, in all seriousness, no. Your channel is really what inspired us to start our channel. It wasn't until we came across yours and we started watching your videos and we were like, oh man, there is so much overlap. And
yeah, I came across your video, how much YouTube pays me for 3,000 subscribers. I actually don't know how it came across my feed. My feed is all golf and fishing videos. So it was interesting that it came across, but it really kind of opened our eyes.
Good old YouTube recommendations.
Yeah.
No, but we, we started the channel. It's been a bit more than a year. We've been really slow growing. Honestly, the channel, like, I feel like the first 80% of our videos are a hot mess. Like, they're absolutely terrible. We had no idea what we were doing.
The last 20% is just lukewarm.
Exactly. So,
yeah,
so I
all
think
of mine are still like that. So there's nothing to worry about.
I reckon we want to continue to improve. Obviously, you know, we want to grow, we want to connect with more people. And just kind of keep it going, see where it goes. What everybody wants to do with YouTube.
Yeah.
Just keep growing and keep improving. And also, I think one of the things that this year we've really committed to the YouTube channel being very personal, and like, we're only going to talk about things that we are specifically doing, and every topic we're going to take through that lens. You know, it's not just generic, like, here's definitions or whatever. And so part of the having the YouTube channel, I love the accountability. So like in a recent video, I did my 2022 side hustles plan. Now I'm committed to putting a course on Skillshare by the end of March, you know? So in that way, it holds us accountable. It helps us in our own practice because we're committed to the audience and to the people who are subscribed. And so I think that's like another kind of cherry on top of doing the YouTube stuff. So
mm-hmm. Yeah,
we're working on it. We're trying to get better.
Yeah, nice. Couldn't agree with you more there. There's a lot of benefits to having a YouTube channel outside of, you know, just growing an audience for the sake of growing an audience or trying to have a side income or whatever. It's like, and I say this probably far too often, people have heard me say this a million times before, but you don't really realize whether you understand something or not till you try to explain it to a camera. And just mm-hmm. kind of like the network that you build up as well. Like we wouldn't be having this conversation if the three of us hadn't gone out and started finance YouTube channels as well. And it's an interesting kind of snowball journey. Like you mentioned, 1,000 subscribers in a year. I think that's slightly faster than I did it. So you're well on track to keep snowballing, hopefully.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. It's been a hard
year.
Emotional journey too.
We almost quit YouTube like 6 times.
Every time we lose a subscriber, it just
Yeah, I vividly remember, I think I had like 108 subscribers or something. That's how seared into my brain this is, the specific 108. I'm pretty sure that's what it was. And then I think I went to sleep, woke up, checked my phone, and I had 106 subscribers. And that was like one of the worst feelings I've suddenly lost to overnight that I worked really, really hard for. But over time it grows.
We know the feeling. Yeah. We know the feeling.
Yeah, funny little YouTube thing, say. And and what are sort of the long-term goals or sort of for the personal finance and investing side? I mean, it sounds like to a significant extent you've basically reached the finish line, but are there still targets you're pushing for or things you're aspiring to?
I think we're at the starting line.
We're at the starting line.
You know, it's a different it's a different phase. It's a different race. You know, I think it's hard. It was hard working at a job you're not passionate about. It'll be a lot harder having to go back to a job you're not passionate about. So, so you know, we really need to continue this and to drive it and to, you know, be successful with our investing, with our side hustles, with everything we're doing on the personal finance side. Mm-hmm. And we don't, you know, we always want to get our money like a snowball or a runaway train so that no matter what we're doing, we don't want our finances to limit us. So, you know, we don't mm-hmm. want to end up at a point where we're in our 50s and we can't do what we want to do because we just
don't have enough money.
We don't have enough money.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that really, I mean, living overseas has been so wonderful in so many ways. And one of the key lessons we've learned is just how much time is the most precious commodity, and being able to spend your time with the people you love and care about, there's nothing more important in the world. And so for us, like, we really want to have experiences with the people that we care about. And like Chris said, we don't want to be limited. So in all transparency, we do have big audacious financial goals, and we want to continue to grow, you know, our wealth for the long term, for as long as we're around, and just, you know, enjoy life to the fullest and have as many experiences as we can with all those people. And so we're gonna keep growing. We love investing in the stock market. I really hope that we get some good real estate opportunities in the coming years, and also expanding into other small businesses and doing more entrepreneurship is something that we really aspire to. So yeah, we just want to keep growing.
Absolutely love it. Well, it's been fantastic talking to both of you. I think that's a really nice place to wrap it up. But before we do that, I want to give you guys a chance to just plug away anything that you want to, where people can go to follow your YouTube channel or anywhere else that they might be able to check out.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Tom. It's the pleasure is all ours. Thank you so much for having us. We're a big fan, and it's just really our pleasure to speak with you. But yeah, our shameless plug is just our channel is called Earn More, Spend Less, Invest the Rest. So if you type that in, we should pop up, and that's it. Just, you know, just follow the YouTube channel. We're going to try to launch a website later this year, but it's not ready yet. So if you're interested to learn more, that's our channel on YouTube.
Great. And yeah, if anyone's listening to the audio only version, that will be in the show notes on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this. And it will be in the description and YouTube if you're watching the video version. So definitely go ahead and check that out. But yeah, thank you both for your time. And it's been great speaking with you. We'll have to do this again one day.
That would be great.
Thank you, Tom.